I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. A major development in the Democratic race for governor. Valerie Ervin, who entered the contest just last month following the death of Kevin Kamenetz, has dropped out and thrown her support to Prince George's County Executive Rushern Baker. Baker and Ben Jealous lead a crowded field in the polls. What will Ervin's decision do for them and for the rest of the governor wannabes? Today on Midday, we'll assess the impact of the Ervin announcement, and we'll analyze other important races in Baltimore County, Baltimore City, and throughout the state ahead of early voting, which begins tomorrow. My guests are Ovita Wiggins of The Washington Post, Pamela Wood of The Baltimore Sun, and William Zorzi of Maryland Matters. Midday on Politics starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you've chosen to spend part of your day with us. Early voting in the Maryland primary begins tomorrow. Marylanders can vote early at locations around the state for a week until June 21st. That's next Thursday. Then there's a four-day break in voting until Election Day on Tuesday, June 26th. A reminder that if you are not yet registered to vote, you can register and vote on the same day if you vote early. You will not be able to register on Election Day. And if Valerie Ervin has her way, you won't vote for her. A short time ago, the former Montgomery County Councilwoman announced her decision to leave the race for governor in the Democratic primary, slimming the crowded field to six major candidates. Ms. Ervin and her running mate, Marisol Johnson, have thrown their support to Prince George's County Executive Rushern Baker and her running mate, Elizabeth Embry. Today on Midday, what Ervin's announcement means for the other candidates on the ballot as Marylanders head to the polls. The last time Maryland held a primary election for important offices like governor, county executives, or state attorney was in 2014. In the primaries that year, barely more than 24% of eligible Democrats participated in the election, and even fewer Republicans cast a vote in their primary. The turnout in the general election was also historically low. According to recent polls, there are still a number of undecided voters in the Democratic race for governor this time around. Perhaps Valerie Ervin's startling announcement will cause more people to focus their attention on this month's primary. In addition to the governor's race, we'll take a look today at some of the other big races that voters will begin to decide tomorrow with a roundtable of three seasoned reporters. Joining me in the studio, Pamela Wood, who covers politics and Baltimore County government for the Baltimore Sun, and William Zorzi. He's a reporter for the online news site Maryland Matters. He was also a Baltimore Sun reporter and editor for nearly 20 years. Welcome to you both. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Good to be here.
Good to have you back. And joining us on the phone from her office in Annapolis, Ovita Wiggins. She broke the story about Valerie Ervin last night. She covers Maryland politics for The Washington Post. Ovita, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, you are welcome to join our conversation. Who are you going to vote for? Who are you looking forward to hearing more from before you make a decision about voting? 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet at @midday WYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming this very minute. So, Ovita Wiggins, Valerie Ervin decides to drop out of the race. She got into the race late following the very unexpected and tragic death of Kevin Kamenetz. What's behind this decision? What do you think?
Well, of course, the decision took a lot of people by surprise, not just that she dropped out, but also that she endorsed Baker. If you look at her positions on policies, Ervin is more closely aligned to Jealous. So it's sort of surprising that not only that she dropped out, but that she went with the Prince George's County Executive, Rushern Baker. I think she was a little deflated by losing the lawsuit, not being able to have her name at the top of the ticket on the ballot. I was able to catch a little bit of the press conference, and she talked about the fact that there were roadblocks from the beginning, the fight to have her name on the ballot. So I think that that may have played a role in her decision to withdraw from the race.
Yeah, just a few days ago, a judge in Anne Arundel County ruled that the state elections board did not have to reprint ballots with her name and Marisol Johnson's name. So the way it was going to work was that if you cast a vote and filled in an oval for Kevin Kamenetz and Valerie Ervin, that would count as a vote for Valerie Ervin and Marisol Johnson. So she did lose that. She mentioned at the time that she thought, and she told me when she was on the program here, this issue is bigger than her. This is a civil rights issue. This is a voter disenfranchisement issue. And she even raised the specter of contesting the election after it was over, understanding that she wasn't going to have any chance to really, you know, have an effective legal remedy before voting starts tomorrow. Did she, has she said anything about that in recent?
She actually mentioned it today during the press conference. In her prepared remarks, she said that this election could be vulnerable to being contested based on her lawsuit, the lawsuit that questioned Krishanti Vignaraja's eligibility to be on the ballot. So she's continuing to raise that point, and I thought that it was kind of interesting that she would raise it today.
Yeah, Pam Wood, it is kind of interesting that she would raise this today. I mean, whoever the Democratic nominee is going to have his or her hands full with Larry Hogan, who's got a huge war chest and a very high approval rating. If you have that plus this other thing nipping at your heels about a possible contested election, boy, that's quite a scenario, isn't it?
Right. One of the things that's going to be important for Democrats after this crowded primary is coming together in unity and backing whoever the winner is. I mean, they're facing Governor Larry Hogan, who has a whole ton of money, a big operation, and like ready to go. The Democrats are going to have, you know, no money. They're going to have to start raising money, getting excitement around their candidate. And if there is a challenge, whether it's from Ervin's camp or somewhere else, that, you know, could potentially cause problems with that. You know, are you going to like move forward and get excitement for your candidate, or are you going to continue to have drama? So that could be an interesting scenario for the Democrats.
So Bill Zorzi, you've covered politics for a long time. Once Kevin Kamenetz died suddenly, which took everybody obviously by surprise, you know, did the backroom phone calling and arm twisting and, you know, canoodling and finagling start to try to see if the ballot could be changed the way it's ended up changing.
Wait, canoodling and finagling. I think many people thought that had been decided in the Oaks case, really. And if there was any doubt, there was an appeal for the Court of Appeals to reconsider their decision not to reprint the ballot.
I'm not necessarily talking about the reprinting of the ballots, but just in terms of, I mean, do you assume or do you know from your reporting that there were phone calls back and forth between the Baker camp, the Jealous camp, the Valerie Ervin camp, the various people who were you know, considered among the top tier candidates? I mean, Kevin Kamenetz was running a close third to Ben Jealous and Rashern Baker at the time of his passing. And a lot of people really just sort of thought it would come down to those three, and it was tough to figure out which of those two might it come down to.
Right. There were a lot of phone calls made, yeah. But I don't know that there was necessarily – those phone calls were between the campaigns. I think they were sort of – among the campaigns, if you will.
But Oviedo Wiggins, this did take people by surprise, right? Did anybody see this coming? Did you have any inkling? Had you heard any rumors or anything?
I started hearing some rumors earlier in the day on yesterday. And so, you know, just tried to reach out to her campaign and expected it to happen. Obviously, she had to make a decision before early voting started. So I knew that if it were going to happen, it was going to happen. Her announcement would happen today sometime.
Mm-hmm. And Pam Wood, part of the issue certainly was money. Kevin Kamenetz had amassed the largest campaign chest of any of the major candidates, about $2 million at the time of his passing. But it turns out that Valerie Ervin didn't have access to that money. So obviously raising enough money to you know, really put forth a formidable campaign was going to be a tough slog.
Right. Valerie Ervin didn't have access to Kevin Kamenetz's campaign account. And the reason is that that money was raised for that candidate, only Kevin Kamenetz. That candidate, you know, no longer exists. So that money can't be used for somebody else. So she had a bit of money in a joint account, and certainly I'm sure she was trying to get new money in. But despite all the media attention she was getting for the getting into the race late and the ballot challenge, she was getting a lot of media coverage, but she was still only polling 5 to 8%. So in some respects, it's kind of not a surprise that actually that any of these lower polling candidates, you know, if any of the others drop out and throw their support behind somebody else, it wouldn't be surprising. Because how long do you go when you only have a limited amount of money, you're polling low digits? I mean, how long do you hang on? Or do you kind of, you know, join
apparently
forces?
Apparently go forever until,
right.
until the election.
Know, it is kind of surprising that we still have all of these candidates, given how poorly several of them are doing.
Yeah, and Bill Zerzi, it's an interesting calculation for voters, isn't it? Because here's a woman, Valerie Ervin, who has, you know, very strong progressive bona fides. As Ovita mentioned, she is really much more politically, philosophically aligned with a Ben Jealous than she is even with a Kevin Kamenetz. But I wonder if a Kamenetz voter, who obviously no longer has that option, is this going to help Rashern Baker pick up those Kamenetz voters, despite the fact that they themselves, if they were inclined towards Mr. Kamenetz, may not be as far on the progressive side as Valerie Ervin?
Well, I think there are a couple things that, if I could just digress for a moment. The
sure.
Early on, you had mentioned it came as a bit of a surprise that Ervin had endorsed Baker or thrown her support to Baker as opposed to Jealous, with whom she's more closely aligned. I think there might be some bad blood there.
Yeah, it sounds like there is.
So
yeah.
I think that's you know, a pretty simple explanation there as far as what else might be involved. I'm not really sure in the Baker administration, but
and Ovita Wiggins, I mean, Valerie Ervin has been public in her criticism and even has leveled some accusations against Ben Jealous about things that happened, you know, during the course of this campaign.
Yeah, she definitely has. Last month, she went public about an accusation that she said that Jealous tried to intervene in keeping her off of Kamenetz's ticket, which led to her having to leave Working Families, where she was working at the time.
And Working Families, of course, had endorsed Ben Jealous.
That's right.
You know, so that was going to be clearly an awkward little party. Pam Wood, Ben Jealous was endorsed this morning by the Baltimore Sun. Rashern Baker was endorsed a few weeks ago by the Washington Post. We should make clear that neither you nor Ovita Wiggins have anything to do with who the editorial boards decide to endorse. On balance, is this a good day or a bad day for Ben Jealous? I mean, he obviously was pretty happy to, I would imagine, to get the Sun's endorsement, and was probably a little less than happy about the news that Ms. Ervin was going to throw her hat in the ring with Mr. Baker.
Yeah, it does seem to be mixed news for Ben Jealous. Assuming that a Baltimore Sun endorsement is a good thing, some people may think it's not a good thing, depending on where you're coming from, to be honest. So it's kind of mixed news for him. We'll see. I actually haven't talked to his camp. I'm expecting to talk to them later today. He's coming here to Baltimore to unveil his economic plan. So hopefully we'll hear from him at that event if he has any reaction to this Valerie Ervin news. And as Ovita mentioned, there's, I believe, no love lost between those two.
Yeah. And Bill Zerzi, have any, you know, policy differences emerged in these final weeks of the campaign between these six Democratic candidates? I mean, we mentioned that three or four of them are polling in single digits and not doing particularly well. But, you know, do voters have clear choices when it comes to people's political philosophies and policy proposals?
Do you have another question in your bag of tricks?
Well, I mean, they're all Democrats, so primaries always, you know, Republicans have the same issue here. Maybe in a primary, it's really difficult sometimes to distinguish yourself on policy. But I wonder if, you know, I mean, I noticed, for example, last night, Real News Network had a forum about education, right, where Rich Modaleno and Ben Jealous got into it a little bit. Ben Jealous saying that his proposal for education includes a 1% tax increase on the top 1% of earners in the state of Maryland. Rich Modaleno said, hold on, we may not need to do that. I mean, are there any other issues that have come across your radar that shows that there's any splits?
In all honesty, no. Yeah. I don't think I've been paying that close attention to the policy, the actual policy differences as much as the horse race, really.
Yeah.
If I could add, I think what separates these candidates less than policy is more leadership style and background and what you're looking for in a leader. I think that's where we have distinct differences. You have Rashearn Baker, establishment, executive experience in government, Ben Jealous, not an elected official, but knows politics from the outside, from the NAACP. You know, you have Obama alums, Krish Vigneraja and Alec Ross. So that's, I think, where there's more differences is leadership style and background, mm-hmm, as opposed to policy, because like they're 90% the same on most things.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Ovita Wiggins, before we take a break, is that your take as well? I mean, are either Mr. Jealous or Mr. Baker, both of whom are leading and basically tied in the polls, if you're to believe the polls, are either of them able to make a stronger case about their capacity to beat Larry Hogan, who's going to be a formidable candidate?
I think for if you're looking at just the two-man race, I think that Jealous represents sort of obviously a shift towards the left. Baker would be seen from a policy standpoint more towards the center, and the question is whether the Democratic Party wants to, you know, have a greater contrast to a Larry Hogan going into the general election.
Ovita Wiggins writes for The Washington Post. Pamela Wood is a reporter with the Baltimore Sun. Bill Zorzi writes for Maryland Matters. By the way, WMAR2 News Television will broadcast a Democratic gubernatorial debate tonight. It was taped a week ago yesterday, and it does include Valerie Ervin. I checked with them this morning, and they are going to run the event as it was recorded last week. The event will also include the two candidates who are not registering in any polls or conducting a real campaign. It will air at 8 o'clock tonight. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we'll take your questions and comments, talk about some of the other races, in particular the race for Baltimore County Executive, which is heating up on both sides of the aisle. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWIPR, and you can also catch us on the WIPR Facebook page where we are streaming. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Midday here on your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, a quick word about tomorrow's show, the final primary season installment in our series of conversations with the candidates. My guest will be Sheldon Laskin. He's a Baltimore lawyer and activist who's challenging incumbent State Senator Bobby Zirkin in District 11 in the Democratic primary. Senator Zirkin's office did not respond to our invitation to join the conversation tomorrow, but we will be speaking with Mr. Laskin. And also, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will join us. She's got a review of The Quickening at Baltimore's Fells Point Corner Theater. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. Today, we're looking at some of the key races in the primary. Early voting begins tomorrow. I'm joined in Studio A by Bill Zorzi. He's a former reporter for the Baltimore Sun. He covers Maryland government and politics for Maryland Matters. Ovita Wiggins is on the phone from Annapolis. She covers Maryland politics for the Washington Post. And Pamela Wood covers Baltimore County government and politics for the Baltimore Sun. If you'd like to join our conversation with your questions and comments, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. We are also streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. By the way, in addition, tomorrow we are going to speak with Valerie Irvin. She will join me here on Midday tomorrow afternoon. So I hope you can join us for that. So Pam Wood, let's talk about Baltimore County. There are two very interesting races, both on the Democratic and Republican side for Baltimore County Executive. Where do things stand there?
Yeah, as a reporter, this is really great. We've got two competitive primaries, both the Democrat and the Republican side, with legitimate candidates, which you don't often get. So there are three Democrats running, and we just did polling this week in conjunction with the University of Baltimore. In the lead, according to our poll of 400 Democrats, is State Senator Jim Brochin with 30%, followed by County Councilwoman Vicki Almond at 22%, and former State Delegate Johnny Olszewski Jr., Johnny O., at 14%. On the Republican side, it's closer. We also polled 400 Republicans, and State Delegate Pat McDonough is in the lead with, I think it was 38 or 39. 5 points behind him is Al Redmer, the insurance commissioner, and the choice of Governor Larry Hogan in that race. And the margin of error was 4.9%. So it's statistically a tie on the Republican side. A little more separation on the Democratic side, but still potential for some movement there.
Mm-hmm. And Bill Zorzi, Maryland Matters, published a piece today or last night about the Democratic primary in which Vicki Allman's allies have set up a super PAC. So it looks like there's going to be an infusion of money from Vicki Allman. She's a Baltimore County councilwoman in the race. She's been a presence on television for sure, as has Senator Brochin, less so in the case of Johnny O. But do you think this boost in the last couple of weeks can help turn things around for Ms. Allman?
You know, it remains to be seen whether it can turn things around, but I believe it would certainly be a factor. That's a, while they're being very hush-hush about who might have donated to this super PAC.
Yeah, as super PACs go, we often don't know where the money comes from.
And we don't know how much she'll have on hand. It potentially can put her on the air. Now, granted, there would be no coordination allegedly between the campaigns because it would be an independent expenditure, but... there's nothing to sneeze at, as the expression goes, unless it turns out come Friday at midnight that she only has $2,000 in there or something. But I don't think that's going to be the case. Yeah. In addition, there are other slates, including Jim Smith's slate, the former county executive out there, who keeps his hand in politics, now works for Mayor Pugh. There are transfers to be had, of some money there.
And I'd add, Jim Smith's slate, the Baltimore County Victory slate, already has been giving money to Vicki Allman's campaign and paying some of the staffers and paying some of their expenses. So not a ton, but from the last report, but that could be a factor as well in these final weeks.
On the Republican side, it's kind of interesting that in a place like Baltimore County, where last time I checked, Larry Hogan has an 85% approval rating. His statewide approval rating is low 70s, 71 or 2%. He is, by most reckonings, the second most popular governor in the United States of America, the other one being another Republican governor of a Democratic state, Charlie Baker in Massachusetts. But given Mr. Hogan's popularity in the county, does it surprise you, Pam Wood, that Pat McDonough is polling so well?
It actually doesn't surprise me at all that Pat McDonough is polling well. He has a strong base of support, particularly on the east side of the county. He's been an elected official for a long time. He has a radio show, and frankly, he's a very exciting candidate. Some people, depending on your policy positions, think it's exciting good versus exciting bad, but he's definitely exciting. And his supporters are very firm. And they're behind him. Al Redmer is the choice of Larry Hogan, and Governor Hogan wants an ally there who can help him get out the vote in Baltimore County, whether he wins or not. Governor Hogan's reelection chances really hinge on Baltimore County. He needs to have a strong showing there. That's what helped propel him to victory before. If you look at Governor Bob Ehrlich, when he won and when he lost, a lot of that you could attribute to how well he did in Baltimore County. But Al Redmer's campaign has been somewhat quiet. He's been ticking it up in the last few weeks. He just went on TV, which is rare. They believe unprecedented for a Republican Baltimore County executive candidate. And he came right out with an attack ad against Pat McDonough. So we're potentially seeing a late surge. Al Redmer had a press conference this morning repeating his attacks on Pat McDonough. So we also saw in our poll that that Redmer's support was from people who were deciding in the recent days or recent weeks. So he could be charging ahead. So while Pat McDonough is strong, we'll see what Redmer does in the final days.
Yeah, I think Redmer came out swinging this morning. I mean, with this press conference, I think it was sort of overshadowed a little bit by the Irvin announcement, and it may have, you know, the coverage may not have been.
And in terms of a turnout in the Republican primary, given the fact that Governor Hogan faces no opposition, he's not going to be drawing people to the polls. Do you think the fact that that's the case, is that going to be good news for strategically and politically for Pat McDonough or for Al Redmer?
It's better news, I think, for McDonough, frankly.
Agreed.
Because he just has that base. You know, I hate to sound like an old guy, but I'm going to sound like an old guy. I learned a tough lesson, as many of us did in 94 in the Republican gubernatorial primary, when everyone thought Helen Bentley was a shoo-in and Ellen Sauerbrey, you know, cleaned her clock in the I think taught us all a lot about
stuff
who votes in Republican primaries.
I mean, conventional wisdom says that primary voters of either side are the more extreme, right? You're going to get your more liberal Democrats or your more conservative Republicans, and that's who Pat McDonough appeals to, more conservative. Redmer's much more moderate in the vein of his boss, Larry Hogan. So, yeah, if it's low turnout, which we're expecting, it could turn out those more conservative Pat McDonough supporters.
Yeah. And Ovita Wiggins, who's still with us on the phone from Annapolis, the state Senate in the legislature is going to change dramatically next year. So is the House of Delegates. I think by last count, there were some 40 members of the House of Delegates who would not be returning. That's out of a body of 141. And there are some races, particularly in the Baltimore City vicinity, that pit young, up-and-coming Democrats against older, more staid, more established, and in some cases, you know, people who have very plum committee assignments. What do you make of the fact that so many of these younger delegates, and sometimes even brand new people to the political scene, are challenging pretty established senators?
Yeah, I think that that many of the progressives, have decided that they want to move the party a little bit to the left. Some of the progressive groups and unions that I've talked to, they say that they are very excited about some of the delegates that are taking on more of the veteran Democrats in the Senate. For example, Delegate Corey McCray taking on Senator McFadden. You have Delegate Mary Washington taking on Senator Conway. And then there's a newcomer who was taking on Senator Zirkin, all of whom seem to be in big fights. I don't watch those races closely, but I get the sense that they are somewhat competitive.
Yeah, and particularly in terms of the Legislative Black Caucus and the Black activist community in Baltimore and the surrounding environs, some of these races are creating some schisms there. I mean, J.D. Merrill, who is a young white candidate, the son-in-law of former Governor Martin O'Malley, is running against Jill Carter, who comes from a very iconic civil rights family. Mr. Merrill has been endorsed by folks like DeRay McKesson, and that set off a bit of fireworks among people in the activist community who are, in most other instances, closely aligned. But it's an interesting dynamic there. And then you have people at the Legislative Black Caucus. They've told me, both on this show and elsewhere, that when it comes to races like Mary Washington versus Senator Joan Carter Conway, she holds a plum seat on the Education Committee, Pam Wood, and they're saying, why would we want to depose a person who's got that kind of clout, regardless of how highly we feel and think about Mary Washington?
Right. Somebody like Senator Joan Carter Conway, she's chairwoman of the Education, Health, and Environmental Affairs Committee, so she's high up in leadership. Senator Nathaniel McFadden is as well. So if these sort of progressive upstart young candidates, if they're successful and there's significant turnover in Baltimore City Senate delegation, these new folks coming in are going to be backbenchers, and somebody else is going to take these leadership roles. So there's some thought, could that influence, you know, the amount of clout that Baltimore City has in the state Senate? It is a small body, but if you maybe lose a bunch of years of experience, but if you gain a sort of newer, more progressive vision of the party, you know, what's the trade-off there? And, you know, we'll really see how that shakes out. And we'll know on June 27th, because if there's any Republican challengers in Baltimore City, they don't stand much of a chance.
I think one of the biggest concerns in the backs of people's minds about the city races and losing experience, in particular Joan Carter Conway's experience, we have two things coming up that will affect Baltimore City deeply, and that would be redistricting and also the Kerwin Commission, the funding for education. And I think there's some concern about whether Baltimore will be at the table, or, you know, the need for Baltimore to be at the table when it comes to carving up the pie,
yeah,
or a variety of pies.
And there are a lot of people who are seeing the contest between Ben Jealous and Rashern Baker as a contest between a Baltimore-centric candidate and a Washington suburb-centric candidate. I wonder, Ovita Wiggins, when it comes to that, the fact that there are such highly contested races for a county executive in Prince George's and Montgomery County, will that be a driver to the polls for Democrats? And if so, do you think a Rashern Baker profits from that, given the fact that he's, you know, a Prince George's County executive and he's right next door to Montgomery County? Does that advantage him in any way? And does Mr. Jealous or the other candidates have some ground to make up in that sense?
Well, I think it could help. Could help Rashern Baker, but obviously he has had a little bit of trouble in his own county. There are a lot of voters who have raised concerns about the way he has handled the school system there. So, you know, voters might be coming to the polls, but I'm not sure whether, you know, the voters in Prince George's will be casting their ballots necessarily for Mr. Baker. He is polling better in Prince George's and Montgomery County, obviously, but the question is how big of a victory he'll have in those two counties. And in regards to the getting to the polls, getting the people out to the polls, the Jealous campaign, well, they actually didn't announce it, but the unions and progressive groups are pouring $1 million into, you know, ad buys as well as get out the vote efforts over the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, and you wrote in a piece in the Post after the Washington Post poll came out that did show Mr. Jealous and Mr. Baker being sort of neck and neck at the top of the heap, that it really does amount to, in a certain way, a tug of war between the D.C. suburbs and Baltimore City. Is there, just generally speaking, does Baltimore, the fact that Baltimore seems to be losing its clout in Annapolis, does that decline, would you predict that decline, if that's how you want to describe it, would continue? Is this race going to be a way of determining whether or not Baltimore can sort of reestablish itself? Ovita, what do you think?
Well, it's an interesting question. Of course, obviously, Ben Jealous is doing better in the Baltimore region, according to the polls, and I think that's another reason why some people, I think even the editorial raised the issue, the Baltimore Sun's editorial raised the issue of he is supportive of Baltimore. He thinks about Baltimore, so I guess that's the question, whether Baltimore winds up sending a candidate who is more Baltimore-centric to the governor's seat.
Mm-hmm. I got a Facebook comment from Morgan Streeter, who writes that the Baltimore Sun poll doesn't reflect the diversity of Baltimore County. A 400-person poll should not sway voters. There are 42,000 Democrats in District 8 alone, and that is one of 6 or 7 districts in Baltimore County. The poll doesn't reflect the county as a whole, in my opinion. It's a tight race, about 20% apiece and 40% undecided. So this poll seems to give an advantage to two candidates when it's actually tighter. The ground game and the last-minute push will have the greatest effect on these voters. He is a supporter of Johnny Olszewski. So, Bill Zorzi, it is an interesting dichotomy. When we're going to take a break here in a second, but Rashearn Baker has a lot of political support. You know, Senator Van Hollen and many of the elected officials at the state and local level have gotten behind him. Ben Jealous has a lot of union support, as Ovita just alluded to. I
mean, and national support.
Yeah, and national. He's campaigning the other day with Dave Chappelle, the comedian. Yeah. do you see one way, one thing or the other being something that sways things, you know, on election day?
I don't really, not in that way. I mean, it really depends on who can get the vote out. And I actually agree with the guy who just wrote in from Facebook regarding the size of the sample of the poll in Baltimore County. And it's just my gut, I think that race is closer than than the poll might indicate.
We're going to take a break, and we'll come back and talk more about all this kind of stuff. It's Politics Day here on Midday. Ovita Wiggins covers Maryland politics for The Washington Post. Bill Zorzi writes about it for the online news site Maryland Matters, which, by the way, I recommend highly. If you haven't checked it out, go to MarylandMatters.com. And Pamela Wood reports on politics and Baltimore County for the Baltimore Sun. Quick break, and then more on races of local interest. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can send us a tweet at Midday WIPR, and you can catch us on the WIPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WIPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking Maryland politics today. Early voting begins tomorrow. It lasts for a week. Primary day is a week from Tuesday, June 26th. And by the way, WIPR will have complete coverage of the election results beginning at 9 o'clock on election night. Hope you'll join me along with WIPR news team and several guest commentators, including political strategist Catalina Byrd and former Secretary of State John Willis, for live coverage primary night in Maryland right here on 88.1 WIPR. Joining me today in Studio A are Pamela Wood of the Baltimore Sun and William Zorzi of Maryland Matters. And with us on the line from Annapolis is Washington Post Statehouse reporter Ovita Wiggins. If you'd like to join our conversations, we'll try to sneak in a couple of your calls and comments. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, to send us a tweet at Midday WIPR, and you can find us on the WIPR Facebook page. So let me go around the room and start with you first, Ovita. I want to talk about the other candidates in the race. Rich Modolina, we've talked a lot about Rashearn Baker and Ben Jealous, who we mentioned. You know, polling is showing that those two are the ones at the top of the heap at the moment. But Rich Modolina, the senator from Montgomery County, Alec Ross, formerly of the Obama administration, Jim Shea, a very well-established lawyer here, is very involved in the educational community in Maryland, and Krish Vignaraja. They are still campaigning as hard as can be. Do any of them, in your estimation, Ovita, have opportunities to break through and get their poll numbers higher by the time voters start heading to the polls tomorrow?
Well, you have Jim Shea, you mentioned. We'll see how much money actually everyone has on Friday, I think, is the next time that we'll see campaign funding numbers. But Jim Shea has always had a great deal of money in the bank. And when you mention the rest of the candidates that are at the lower tier, he's the one who has raised quite a bit of money, and of course, money helps in terms of trying to get your folks out to the polls. Madalino is just coming off of an interesting ad that he put out last week that went viral. I think that probably helped bump him up a little bit. It got his name out there a little bit more. It was an ad. The idea behind the ad was take that Trump. There was no mention of Larry Hogan, but it was definitely trying to let voters know that he described himself as the best person to to take on Trump, that he has the progressive credentials to do that. Krishanti Vignaraja, she continues to talk about the fact that she is her ticket is the only all-female ticket, and in this year of the woman, she's hoping that some of her, that she'll be able to bump it up a little bit as well.
Pam, what do you think? I mean, is it, unfortunately, it's not unusual for candidates to start placing negative ads about their opponents in the last week or two of the campaign in order to break through. Let's hope that doesn't happen, frankly. But, I mean, what do you think? Are there particular lanes that some of these other candidates can take to start challenging the leaders?
So far, they've all been mostly kinds of hands-off. We're starting to see a little bit of Baker and Jealous go after each other a bit. There was some of that, I believe, at the press conference this morning. It's hard to go from 1 or 2 or 4% to whatever the margin you're going to need to win, maybe 30% or so in this race. So that's a long way to go, even with all the undecideds. Perhaps Senator Madaleno has a shot. I think it was the Post poll had a question about who's the best to take on Larry Hogan, and Madaleno performed well there, which maybe that indicates
better than anybody else.
Yeah, maybe that indicates he's a second choice. Or I mean, I think Democrats have a choice between: do you want the candidate who matches your values and your perspectives the most, or do you want to pick the candidate who's going to win? So maybe some people are seeing Madaleno as that he could go against Hogan very well, but. Even Madaleno, if, you know, some people, as the Facebook writer said, don't really buy into polls. But if you believe that Madaleno's a long shot, anybody outside that, I mean, I just don't see a path to victory.
Well, Bill Zerzi, the polls were perfectly predictable in the 2016 presidential campaign. Everybody knew Trump was going to win that one.
They were. And I was proud to say that I lost a lot of money in that deal. I mean, if I were a betting man, I would have lost a lot of money. I just want to just... I'm not going to defend this, but I just wanted to point out that the writer in her was dealing with the Baltimore County poll in particular, not the gubernatorial poll, the fact that he questioned it. But, I think, unfortunately, Rich Madaleno has sort of been lost. I think he has a pretty good message. He's a smart guy. He's been around a long time.
Certainly knows his policy, knows the budget probably better than anybody in the legislature at this
point.
Yeah, he has that kind of reputation that, you know, Pete Rawlings used to have back in the day.
And he knows how to needle Governor Hogan, that's for sure.
Yeah. Let's see if we can sneak in a phone call. Leslie in Glen Arm, welcome to the program. I guess you want to talk about one of the congressional races. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I live in Glen Arm in North Baltimore County, and I have to say, wow. Our race has gotten very excited. I've lived in Baltimore County for more than 20 years, and I would like some reflections of your panelists regarding the changing demographics in North Baltimore County, and also the Andy Harris race and the Wade Catch race.
All right. Pam, you cover the county. What do you think?
Yeah, I can't really speak to the Andy Harris race so much, but Wade Catch is the county councilman for sort of central and northern Baltimore County, so kind of like Timonium and north. He's a former state delegate, former teacher, very experienced in politics, and he's a Republican, and this is a strongly Republican-dominated area, and he's getting multiple challengers in the Republican primary. And as well, there are some Democrats who believe that, you know, they can seize this blue wave and try and flip that council seat. That appears to be a challenge to me. But it is interesting to get a sitting councilman, primaried in the Republican primary.
Yeah, and Bill Zerzi, when it comes to this congressional race in the first congressional district, which is a seat held currently by Andy Harris, the incumbent Republican, he's got two challengers in his primary, and the Democrats have put up six candidates running for the chance to beat Andy Harris. Andy Harris, the only Republican member of the Maryland congressional delegation. There's a guy named Jesse Colvin who's running. People have compared him to Connor Lamb, the guy who won that Trump district in Pennsylvania. As well as Allison Galbraith, who's a progressive, new to politics. She describes herself as a single mother and a small business owner. It's interesting that people are not shying away from taking on Congressman Harris.
No, not at all. I'm not sure how well a progressive does in the First District of Maryland, but I've heard some talk if Jesse Colvin can make it through the primary, that he could give Andy Harris a run for his money come November.
Yeah.
But I'm just not on the ground there at the moment.
Fair enough. Let's see if we can get one more call. Dale in Greenmount West, thanks for calling Midday. Appreciate your quick question. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I was just going to say the main reason I'm not supporting any incumbents in the 45th District of Maryland is because their main argument is sending them back to Annapolis is the fact that they have seniority. That's not good enough for me. And they're not adjusting to the new realities that Baltimore is not the political powerhouse in the state any longer. And as far as the Democratic gubernatorial candidates, I'm on the fence for all of them. But honestly, in the general election, I think I'm going to be supporting Hobey.
And are you a registered Democrat or a Republican?
No, I'm a registered Democrat. But right now, if this was a general election, as far as the governor is concerned, I probably would be supporting Hogan because I can't see anything. I mean, Ben Jealous and that other guy, Deshaun Baker, they seem to me like they're running against Trump. He ain't on the ballot.
All right. Well, thanks for that comment, Dale. I appreciate it. Ovita Wiggins, it's interesting. Larry Hogan won the election the last time around by about 56,000 votes. John Willis, the former Secretary of State, had an interesting observation the other day. He was on this show. He said, if Mr. Hogan gets every single vote he got the last time, and if Democratic turnout is better than it was the last time, because it was historically low the last time, Mr. Hogan can lose by 100,000 votes. So there's not a lot of people say, well, here's this incredibly popular governor. But there are other people who say, you know, there is a path to beating Mr. Hogan, given the fact that if you bring Democrats out, if you get people voting and get them engaged, this is certainly a big part of the pitch that Ben Jealous has been making, is it not?
That is the big pitch that he's been making, that Maryland is a 2-to-1 Democratic state, and if you get the voters out, then a Democrat will be back in the governor's seat.
I don't know whether
the gentleman who just called, he's a Democrat, but he's squarely in, plans to vote for Hogan. So I don't know whether that actually will work, the idea that if you just bring out Democrats that they're automatically going to vote for their Democratic candidate.
Because Bill Zerzi, this caller is not alone in being a Democrat who's perfectly satisfied with the job that Governor Hogan's done.
Right. And that guy, I would like to talk to that guy a little more. It sort of gives credence to the poll that I sort of scratched my head about. I guess it was the Sun poll that showed the 42% favoring Hogan in the general, in Baltimore City.
And he matched up against each of the candidates, very well. As we said, Rich Modolano being the one that came closest to challenging him. Yeah.
Yeah, I would think with, like, Democrats, they're going to have to convince their voters that they really need to knock off Larry Hogan and that their guy or gal is going to be the better choice. Because I think, just like the caller, there's a lot of people who say, well, he's done fine. He hasn't done anything I super dislike. So he's got my vote.
Well, that's all the time we have. I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to talk about the state's attorney's race here in Baltimore City. A very interesting race between Marilyn Mosby, the incumbent, Ivan Bates, a challenger, and Thiru Vignaraja, the brother of Krish Vignaraja, who is running for governor. But Ovita Wiggins from the Washington Post, Pam Wood of the Baltimore Sun, and Bill Zerzi of Maryland Matters, very grateful to all of you for being here. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So lunch for our guests today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies, with locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the Square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. More information on the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. Coming up tomorrow, our series of conversations with the candidates concludes with Sheldon Laskin. He's challenging incumbent State Senator Bobby Zirkin in District 11. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews The Quickening at Baltimore's Fells Point Corner Theater. And I will speak with Valerie Irvin, the now erstwhile candidate for governor. She's going to be joining us at the top of the hour tomorrow on Midday. Once again, if you're planning to vote early, you can do so as of tomorrow. We have a link to the list of locations for early voting on our website, wypr.org/midday. You have from tomorrow until June 21st, and if you aren't registered, you will be able to both register and vote if you vote early. You will not be allowed to register on Election Day, June 26th. That's it for us today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, coming up after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.